Can we move to department updates?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. So how about if we start with learning what's happening with the Nurse Family Partnership?
Wanted to make sure I don't cut in front of anyone. So Pat Shaw, Program Manager of Nurse Family Partnership. And I've got, I think, 10 slides and a few things to read aloud to you, if you'll bear with me with that. So Nurse Family Partnership, this is some PowerPoint slides from their website along with some ones that I created or clients created when they wrote a note to their nurse about what they appreciated about NFP. So Clark County Public Health has had a Nurse Family Partnership program since 2007, so 10 years now. We've always had four nurses. It's not a mandated program, so you can help me out with your technology right now. It's not a mandated program, so we've had financial threats throughout the years, like every 2 years, this dark cloud, I won't call the dark cloud Jeff Parkinson, but he has something to do with it. He's very supportive of the program, as is all of the leadership team, which I so appreciate when I see so many health departments not doing any direct services anymore. But because Nurse Family Partnership is an evidence-based program with years of research, our leadership team has been very supportive of it continuing to be available in the community and for public health nurses to be the ones doing the program. So our leadership team engaged with Peace Health, and you're going to hear more about that, but I'm also very appreciative of Peace Health. So let's see, to move on, I just do the arrow down. There we go.
Look at that.
You can tell I did this a lot. Wow, even phased in. I didn't know we could do that. Dr. David Olds, a PhD, is the founder of Nurse Family Partnership. Al Melnick has actually participated in some research with David Olds and their buddies. So this is a quote from him, from Dr. Olds. There's a magic window during pregnancy. It's a time when the desire to be a good mother and raise a healthy, happy child creates motivation to overcome incredible obstacles, including poverty, instability, or abuse, with the help of a well-trained nurse. So let's see here. So Dr. Olds, I think it was while he was going to college, he was teaching in an inner city daycare in the late 70s. And that's when his experience caused him to suspect that by age 4 or 5, some kids who come from disadvantaged homes were already in trouble. He began to think hard about when to get involved to help these kids, and his investigation led him to develop a program for first-time mothers. Oh, sorry. Nurse Family Partnership is an evidence-based community health program. They've been doing research for like 40 years on it. Our nurses do a lot of paperwork. You're going to drive to I can sort of multitask. So transforms lives of vulnerable first-time mothers living in poverty, improving prenatal care, quality of parenting, and life prospects for moms by partnering them with a registered nurse starting in the prenatal period until the child turns 2. And we do all we can to involve dads too. So every dollar invested in NFP can yield more than $5 in return, so it's good economically. So I have an asterisk by first-time mothers. Our program is one of the few around the country who is participating in a pilot project with the University of Colorado, which is the research arm of NFP where Dr. Olds works. And what they found was working with multips, so women who are having not their first child but subsequent kids, that on Indian reservations, that they've had some really good outcomes with serving those moms in addition to first-time moms. So now they're expanding that to the general public, general community, and so we're trying to spread the word that for the next 9 or 10 months, we can enroll multips and serve them till that child turns 2. But as public health nurses, they're there for the whole family, so they'll be assessing any needs that the older kids might have too, but the index child will be the one that the mom is carrying. They always say babies don't come with instruction manuals, but if there was one, the nurse family partnership would be it. So that's a mom in Pennsylvania. So this is an NFP slide where they're showing early brain development and that is impacted by NFP's interventions with the mom and connecting her with resources, everything from improving her nutrition to cutting down on smoking to the services she needs to be able to succeed with getting clean and staying clean if she is someone who has addiction issues. So it's the timing is great because it starts prenatally and it goes till the child turns two. And while I'm thinking about that, we also try to think of the home visiting programs in our community as kind of a continuum. And sometime in that second year of the child's life, I really encourage our nurses to, if the parent is willing, to refer the family to Early Head Start, which is also a prenatal to age three program. So then they can have, because NFP ends at age two, they can have Early Head Start till age three, and then they're more likely to be able to get into Head Start. And all of those programs together help kids be more ready for school. Oh, so this you can't really read, but I can read it to you. I'll read it kind of fast, because these are fairly long, but they're so great. So the nurses are supposed to be giving their clients some pretty paper when the client graduates from NFP, and then the client hopefully will write something about what the program meant to them and mail it to me. What I like about Nurse Family Partnership. When I found out I was pregnant, it was unexpected. My partner and I have been together 16 years. We really didn't think it could happen. So I was in shock and honestly scared. I went to my first appointment to confirm the news. That's when I saw the Nurse Family Partnership brochure. I took it home and read through it. I felt amazed and relieved there was such a program in existence. A phone call was placed. I was told how to sign up. I anxiously awaited a response. Not long after, a wonderful woman named Daphne contacted me for our appointment, and that was when I had a wonderful partner who graciously walked me through my pregnancy and the first 2 years of my beautiful son's life. To me, this program is a lifeline. Our partner, Daphne, became a part of our family, always there to coach and reassure us along the way. I really feel we wouldn't be where we are without her or this program. Just a few words about how I feel about NFP. Essential, comforting, fun, educational, nice. NFP. Thank you from our family, Megan. I might not read all of them because I brought a few. Okay, so key program components. I'm behind. I didn't say a lot of what was on my notes, but that's okay. Let's see here. So, and on this one, I'm just gonna really read the ones on the left if they show up. There they are. So the goals are to improve pregnancy outcomes, improve child health and development, and improve parents' economic self-sufficiency. A big part of what our nurses do with clients is talk with them about their life goals, their heart's desire, as NFP calls it, and try to help them move towards that in the time that the nurse has with the family. And so that includes schooling, career. We seem to have a lot of clients right now involved in CNA programs. CNA, I know what a CNA is. The C wasn't coming to me. All right, so I think that's good for that one. And then, yeah, you can't read that. But this one, she says, NFP's been my rock for over 2 years. Being pregnant and then actually caring for a baby is a hectic, scary, and rewarding experience. So she just goes on to say how helpful her nurse was, gave her peace and guidance. Without NFP, I really don't know how I would have made it this far. It's truly an amazing program that I wish every mother could have. All right. And then this is just a little bit about our program here. So a total of 577 women have been enrolled since 2007. The majority of the kids are 19 and younger. And when you look at that group, the majority are 15 to 17. The annual household income around 9,000. They're Medicaid eligible clients. 85% were unmarried at program entry, and 41% had completed high school at program entry. Let's see, what else could I tell you? So the nurses are specially trained. They go to for a week to Denver for specialized NFP training. Typical caseload being 17 to 23 pregnant or parent and clients, depending on if they're a 0.8 FTE nurse or full-time. And then in addition to that would be the infants and toddlers on the caseload. Most of the clients have at least one of the following risk factors: interpersonal violence, substance use themselves or in their environment, mental health diagnosis, or homelessness. So a lot of what our nurses do is connect clients to services. This one, what I like about NFP, a kind and caring nurse that comes to your home on a regular basis. My nurse Joan was eager to help with my many questions about my changing body from birth to 2 years old. She brought lots of good reading material. Healthcare is so confusing these days, but Joan helped me navigate and helped me find myself and my daughter Chloe good doctors and dentists. She listened and genuinely cared. This program is amazing in my opinion. So this quote, so what was cool was this client added quotes that weren't her own, I don't think, but she doesn't give credit, but this one sounded familiar. Too often we underestimate the power of a touch, a smile, a kind word, a listening ear, an honest accomplishment, or the smallest act of caring, all of which we have the potential to turn, all of which have the potential to turn a life around. So I have some NFP brochures if anyone wants to see them. Any questions for me before I introduce Marla?
Talk a little bit more about the how, I know the answer, but I mean, I want to have you share with the group, how, you know, that return on investment, what, where are those dollars being saved?
So there's saved in the TANF, the welfare program, food stamp program, and so there's that monetary piece, but what they say statistically is kids do better in homes where the parents are employed or have a little higher income. So that it's just multiple benefits if we can help these moms to be more self-sufficient, everything from self-esteem to just, you don't make a lot of money when you have welfare. So I think anytime we can help them to find work that is meaningful and that they can, you know, feel a lot better about themselves too. So those are some of the main areas.
Well, I was thinking as well, you know, nationally the data shows that, you know, mothers are spending less time in jail. There's less legal costs, the law and justice system, less mothers going to jail, less kids get older.
Yeah, actually there's outcomes 15 years down the road. So these kids have fewer interactions with juvenile justice. They end up having a higher high school, like the 2-year-olds, when they get older, have a higher graduation rate, I believe. I mean, you've got the outcomes, but basically what's remarkable about this program is it's an ACEs mitigation program. So when we think about all the ACEs complications we've already talked about here, these nurses, and you guys might remember from the ACEs study that one of the resilience factors is to have a caring adult around, and the nurses actually play part of that role. They've actually built resilience not only of the mother, but of the child as well. So a lot of these positive outcomes are many years down the road. And it's actually, for me, what gets me excited about this is that besides the wonderful better birth outcomes, this is the essence of chronic disease prevention. These kids are less likely to have other chronic diseases as they get to adulthood. So anyway, I'm sorry.
Thank you. No, that's good.
How do they get plugged in? So who recommends them? Do they just call a number or
so different ways. Typically they're referred by their prenatal care provider, but we also get referrals from the teen parent programs. It's called FRADS at the Evergreen and Vancouver school districts. I just came from the Teen and Young Parent Community Collaborative that brings together folks that work with teen parents, and we spread the word about NRP at those meetings too.
I could hear the emotion in your voice when you were reading the letters.
Aww.
And I saw your face get a little flushed, and I think you're very close to the program, and that's a wonderful thing. And I wonder what it's like for the nurses when they have to separate themselves from the families, if that's difficult, or they continue to stay in touch.
So one of our newest nurses, Elise, she early on enrolled a client that is dealing with recovery issues and then had a baby with cystic fibrosis. So that child's now two. Well, actually, let's see. So Elise, this client came to Elise from a nurse that retired. But anyway, Elise bonded with her, and this client never came to visits. But when it came time for their graduation, when the child was two and they were going to have a celebration, the client canceled three times. And another nurse will be visiting through a children with special health care needs program because of the little girl. But and then they both were teary at it, and they do somewhat stay in touch, but I have to really, boundaries are so important in this program because there's not enough time to serve all the clients on your caseload, and stay in touch and meet for coffee with your graduates, but they will often hear from their graduates down the road and how they're doing, and yeah, it's not easy for the client or the nurse.
Yeah.
Yeah, good question. Yeah. Yes?
And just, I was wondering, in our community, do we have much housing that's available for, like, these young homeless moms? Is there?
So there's three maternity homes that I'm aware of. One's called Vita's Ark, one's called New Beginnings, and one's called Mom's Place. The first two I mentioned, I think, are religious-based, but I don't think Mom's Place is. It's out in Battleground. So that's a place that our nurses will refer and have often had clients staying. One of my nurses says we really need more shepherd homes or shepherding homes. And so it was cool, after the article ran in the Columbian a few Saturdays or Sundays ago, I think Saturdays. Anyway, I got a call from a retired teacher wanting to know how she could volunteer with our program or with young families. And when I listed a bunch of needs in our community, not just NFP-wise, but different programs, and including shepherding homes, she says, oh, well, I have an extra bedroom in my condominium. I could be a shepherding home just right off the bat.
Wow.
I told her, be careful what you're saying, you know. So I'm trying to figure out how really to incorporate her in our program, or because we aren't allowed with NFP to even send a student nurse to the client's home without the nurse along. There's all this fidelity to the program. So, but I'm sure we'll be able to utilize her somehow. So that is a neat shepherding home. So
what is a shepherding home?
I think, I haven't looked it up, but I think it's just a family who has an extra bedroom willing to take in a pregnant client through delivery and a while after and be supportive of them. Yeah, we have a lot of homeless or couch surfing families. Well, this would probably break HIPAA, so I can't say it, but there's clients experience suicides in their family, all kinds of things, or dogs that are elderly and the client doesn't have the means to figure out what to do with them. So a retired NFP nurse helping out a current NFP nurse to take the client and the dog to the vet. So they just, you know, they do it all. Those are great questions. So Marla Sanger is here from Peace Health. Welcome, yep. Marla, and you don't need the computer.
I do not. What I really wanted to tell you all about is how Peace Health and the Clark County Public Health Department NFP program came together. And can you hear me okay without me? I think I'll go with that.
I didn't use it either.
That's okay. So Peace Health, like many not-for-profit hospitals, has always had a community benefit program. And part of that is because it's our mission at Peace Health to serve the community. There's words in our mission statement that say that we're to promote personal and community health, relieve pain and suffering, and treat each person in a loving and caring way. So that's really important to our identity as an organization. But in addition to that, nonprofit hospitals are required to give back a certain amount of financial equivalency into the community to continue to enjoy the nonprofit status that they have. And so that is very closely monitored by the IRS. but the IRS regulation really doesn't get me excited, like the mission does. I mean, the mission is very exciting to me. It's very much a piece of the organization that I think is pretty powerful. And Peace Health is not the only one that has a really strong commitment to the community. Many hospitals and healthcare systems do, most of them do. So Peace Health was wanting to figure out how to create more tangible results when investing in community health. And knowing that the only way that can work is to get partnerships that know how to do community health, because Peace Health is a hospital and they have medical clinics and they treat people when they're already sick or when they're hurt. And so when I was hired, we were just starting this new program. It's now called Community Health. I was one of three across our three states, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, to get to work on this. And we formed a board committee, members of the board, as well as other content experts and a few folks. Dr. Melnick is on this board committee for Peace Health Southwest, and each hospital has this board committee in Cross Peace Health. And the function of that committee is to take a look at the community health needs assessment that we create every 3 years, as required by the IRS, and look for, and by the way, those are very heavily informed by stakeholders in the community, and look at the needs that were identified and try to think of how we can help alleviate those concerns or those problems. And so having Dr. Melnick on that committee is really helpful because he's an expert at how to address community needs. And one of the very first proposals that came to us was the Nurse Family Partnership Program. The board committee took it under advisement, really studied the program, really looked at it. That caught the interest of some people that were on a couple of different boards with Peace Health here in Southwest Washington. And they began to try to generate some interest about figuring out a way that we could help as a funder to help support the program so that it could grow toward sustainability. And so this was the first program that I was able to bring forward to Peace Health as a formal request for some funding that would be joined by a foundation that was able to contribute funds to the hospital that could then be used in any way the hospital felt necessary, and this is the way that was decided. So it's a partnership that will be very solidly intertwined for the next 3 years because that we were able to obtain funding that will carry us that long. And then during that time, we'll be able to work together to try to see what we can do to make the program self-sustainable, or not self-sustainable, but to be able to attract and keep funds to maintain the program and grow the program. That would be our hope. So that's where Peace Health comes into the picture. And I think you're gonna speak next, Alan.
Well, I'll just say a few words here. First of all, Marla is very modest. Her leadership in this community has been incredible. She's had community benefits, and she's how long you've been here, it didn't take you really long to really make a whole lot of community connections. And she's involved in a lot of other things as well. She's on the board of the Southwest Cannibal Community of Southwest Washington Cannibal Community of Health, and has been, and obviously here at Public Health Advisory Council. The Peace Health Board, incredible community board, a lot of great partners there, and the mission, and the mission of the NFP and Peace Health are really intertwined. So it's a great partnership. And what she didn't mention is we're talking about nearly $1 million here. So
wow.
Peace Health has actually provided $300,000 a year for the next 3 years for the Nurse Family Partnership. So it's a substantial contribution. They've really stepped up to the plate. And I think our own Board of Health was really helpful because they committed some of the mental health sales tax dollars to the NFP. And I think that's appropriate because, as we mentioned earlier, first of all, a lot of the families have issues around mental health and substance use and domestic violence. And actually, this program helps prevent substance use disorder as well as chronic mental illness in the children as they get older. So there's a lot of reasons for doing that. But Peace Health really stepped up to the plate. It's been a it's always a challenge in public health to find funding to keep these programs like this going on. And we will be reaching out, but the fact that Peace Health stepped up to do this really gives us some leverage to reach out to other community partners to make this program sustainable. So this is really, it's an incredible move, and I get excited about it because it is, besides helping the moms and the families and the babies out, it's really, for me, it gets my juices flowing about chronic disease prevention and health promotion in general. So that's about.
The other thing that, and I just wanted to share Pat and Dr. Mellett's gratitude. This is an innovative type of a partnership, and we really wouldn't have been here without Marla's stewardship, and we really greatly appreciate all of her ongoing support and this partnership, and we're very excited about what's to come. We have a lot of ideas for the program, and not only do we want to see it sustained, but we also want to see it expand because there is such a need in the community. So we're very excited for the years to come, and we again greatly appreciate the work. And we all actually do have an event. Did you want to talk a little bit about the event coming up?
We're excited to share that we are going to have a little get together. It will be a fairly small, intimate group. We're going to gather at the First and Bird Tower lobby at Peace Health Southwest. It'll be our friends from the Clark County Public Health Department, a number of people in the community that have a commitment to this program, and all of you are invited as well. I'm going to pass around some invitations. It'll be on Tuesday, October 24th, and just 1 hour, so you don't have to commit a lot of time from 4 to 5. We'll have some very pretty refreshments, and we'll hear a few comments, and the main purpose for having it is to be able to just celebrate the fact that we have come together in a partnership that we think will continue to grow and flourish. And as the Public Health Advisory Council, you're part of that. So I hope that each and every one of you will feel welcome to come and join us and share in this celebration and get to know some of the other people that are involved in this partnership. I believe we have a couple of our county councilors that have RSVP'd that they're interested in coming. So I think it'll be a real wonderful event. So I'm going to pass these around.
The one other thing I want to build on what Roxanne said is we're only seeing a fraction of the eligible families in the county. So if we are able to find additional funding, we can actually expand it. So thank you. So we're that's our next mission here.
So I just wanted to again another round of applause. The RSVP information is at the bottom. It's an email address that you can RSVP to, or you can also call any one of us here at Public Health and we'll give you the RSVP.
And please do so that we can have an accurate head count for our refreshments. That would be really helpful to see you there.
All right, thank you so much. So we are going to, there she is. Okay, we're move on to Madison is going to talk to us about the salmonella outbreak and the response process.
Before she starts, have you folks met Madison before? I can't remember.
I don't think I've met anything.
So I should tell you a little bit about Madison. So Madison is a fellow through the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists. It's actually a CDC funded program, and it's incredibly competitive. So people with master's degrees and doctor's degrees in epidemiology from around the country, and there's hundreds of applicants, literally hundreds of applicants for, I believe, about 20, 25 spots across the country. We're one of the approved sites, and Madison is, like, she's the cream of the crop in terms of epidemiologists graduating with master's and doctoral degrees. And we've been fortunate to have her. It's a 2-year fellowship, and we've been here about a year and a couple of months, and has done, anyway, she's pretty incredible and is gonna talk to you about how we do foodborne outbreak investigations.
Thanks for setting the bar.
You will not disappoint.
No, well, thank you for that. Like you said, my name is Madison, and I'm actually going to talk a little bit about today, about some of the work I've done with the communicable disease team here on one of the things that I feel is really integral to public health practice here, and that's investigating foodborne illness concerns and outbreaks in our community. So I'm basically going to start by just explaining how we do that here at Clark, what our primary goals are, and why it's important. I'll talk a little bit about the process of investigating foodborne illness complaints and outbreaks. And then I'm going to touch on a recent and actually still ongoing outbreak that we're investigating right now of salmonella. So first off, this kind of just shows, gives an idea of the burden of foodborne illness concerns that we receive here at Clark every year. So we have a system here where basically anybody who lives in our community can call, email, submit something on our website if they have a concern about something public health related. And many of those have to do with foodborne illness or some sort of food-related illness. They maybe ate at a restaurant and got sick afterwards, or went to an event where they think that they may pick something up. They then are able to submit that concern to us, and then it's filtered through our team and sent to the correct investigator for that concern. And so you can see here, we receive anywhere from about 100 to 130 concerns from citizens in the community every year relating to foodborne illness. And we like to investigate and follow up with every single one of those, so that's certainly a decent workload that we have to do in the communicable disease team to follow up with them. This is really important because when it comes to identifying outbreaks related to restaurants or foodborne illnesses, a vast majority of them, 88%, come from complaints we receive through this system. So there are certain conditions that labs and providers are required to notify us about, but many times people don't seek the medical care that they need, or there's a delay with the lab testing and things like that. So really a majority of the outbreaks that we detect are through that complaint system. So it's really important for us to have a robust system to following up with those concerns. So with that in mind, our primary goals of this investigation process are just to have a consistent, thorough response to these in our community. Defining our team roles, there's a lot of people and a lot of moving parts when it comes to these investigations, so we want to make sure that everybody is clear on their roles and responsibilities. We want to collect data and be able to use it in an effective way. And then we want to be able to provide training and resources for our staff and as people join to be able to continue this response in an effective way. So I'm going to kind of go into what we call here our foodborne illness toolkit. And when I say toolkit, it encompasses a lot of things. That goes from templates, it's data organization tools, it's a lot of things that help us best address foodborne illness concerns and outbreaks. But really the crux of this all is just this comprehensive document we put together, which has everything from procedures on how to go through this, investigation checklists for things that I would never have even thought of until somebody else brought it up. So it's kind of a lot of people's brain power put into one document for us to reference. It also highlights the roles and responsibilities of the investigation team. And something unique about Clark is a lot of other jurisdictions, when they investigate foodborne illnesses, they have one team or one person who does it. So it'll just go to the communicable disease team and they'll do the whole part. Or it'll just go to the environmental team and they'll do the whole thing. But really here we developed a system because we realize that there's a lot of pieces and components to an investigation, and it's really important for us to pull on those specialists. So we want the environmental health specialist to go out to the restaurant and do the environmental assessment. We don't want a nurse or myself going out there to do that because that's not our specialty. So through this, we've really been able to draw on people's areas of focus to be able to develop a comprehensive response. So this is kind of an overview of our foodborne illness investigation process, and I'm just going to kind of quickly walk through these steps. Basically, we'll first receive an illness either through the reportable conditions or through that concern system that I mentioned to you. And with that, the first step is just evaluating that illness and the concerns. You know, we will go through and we'll interview any of the individuals that are that maybe submitted a concern or that are implicated in the lab result. We'll review their medical records to see if there's any more information in there we didn't gather. We have standardized questionnaires we go through to maybe probe for information that they wouldn't have thought to disclose to us, or maybe there are four other restaurants they ate at on that same day besides just the one that they told us about. So really to kind of identify all of the possibilities and figure out exactly what could be going on. The next step then is to review environmental evidence with that. That basically allows us to go through, look at the history of a facility that may or may not be connected to an illness, see if they've maybe had some other things come up that would be areas for concern, maybe they have high-risk foods that they serve, things like that, that would just allow us to determine if that illness that we're seeing is potentially related to that facility.
Madison, can I ask, what would be a high-risk food?
So something like raw or undercooked meats or fish would be a high-risk food.
Sushi.
Sushi, which this is good foreshadowing. or high-risk processes. If somebody has a really large menu, that just means there's a lot of things they have to keep track of, and there's a higher chance that there will be cross-contamination. Things like that are just higher risk for foodborne illnesses. And so when we look at facilities, we want to make sure that we pay a careful eye on places like that. Buffets, things like that are kind of a place where we can see a higher risk for illness. So there's a lot of different criteria, but it's all things that we have to keep in mind. And then the next step in kind of the regular investigation process is determining if an outbreak's occurring. We could have just like one person who said that they got ill after eating somewhere. We could determine maybe, maybe not, it wasn't related to that. But what really kind of turns things going escalating is if there's an outbreak occurring. So if we have multiple people who are saying, we ate at the same restaurant, we worked together at all any other time, then you can kind of put the pieces together and say, maybe there's something going on here. Once we determine if an outbreak is occurring, things kind of go down this other path where we do a more intensive investigation. We complete a more thorough assessment of the facility. We have our environmental specialists go out and they screen for things like ill food workers, or see if they had any complaints themselves, or if they've changed producers, if they've added new menu items. Basically a really, really intensive questionnaire of just what could potentially be going on here. The other thing we do is gather more information on potentially exposed individuals. We talk to those people who are sick, and we talk to the people who ate with them who didn't get sick. And by knowing, these people ate this food and got sick, these people didn't get sick, but they didn't have this food item. Doing that comparison allows us to pinpoint exactly what food item or what exposure potentially made somebody sick. We kind of collect all of that data, the environmental data, the interview and health data, put it together, and that allows us to really draw some sound conclusions that are evidence-based and reliable based on the information we have. And in the end, we communicate those results. We partner here with our communications team and our public information officer when putting those results out, just because, that person is the expert in communications. So we bring that team in order to come up with these final reports and communicate with media if necessary, things like that, really to wrap up the investigation well and communicate with the appropriate stakeholders. So now I'm gonna kind of switch gears here and talk about the process that I just went through in the context of an outbreak investigation that we've been going through and are still going through at this point, actually. So you guys are getting like up to date information on all of this. I'm gonna kind of just walk through the calendar and like walk through how we've investigated this. So starting back in late August, we received 5 cases of salmonella reported to us from a lab or provider all in one day, which just for context, we usually receive about 3 to 8 cases a month. So getting 5 cases in one day was like a giant red flag ringing a bell. We were like, okay, something has to be going on here. We kind of divided and conquered, trying to reach out to all these people and do interviews. We were able to interview 3 of the 5 cases. The other 2 kind of outstanding, hadn't returned our phone calls. And we really didn't find anything. Nobody seemed to have common exposures. Nothing really stood out to us as high-risk things. So we were like, okay, well, maybe this is just a really weird coincidence.
And is this something that all hospitals are required to report the salmonella when they get studies from the lab? And that's like a 3? How long does it take for them to do the fecal test?
If somebody goes and seeks healthcare for their illness and they provide a specimen, they'll send it to the lab, they can isolate if it's salmonella. And a lot of times the labs will do just a rapid test and it'll tell yes or no because it's salmonella.
Actually, there are, by law, there are 3 required reporters. Hospitals are required to report, physicians, healthcare providers are required to report, and labs are required to report. In reality, we're more likely to receive a report from a laboratory because it's kind of like, it's more automated there. Mm-hmm. But by law, and we can give you the statutes and the WACs if you're interested, it's required.
So physicians are required to report you.
Yeah, within, and depending on the bug, the notifiable condition, within a certain amount of time.
Yeah. And it's important with things like salmonella, which are pretty contagious and can spread quickly. We like to hear about those as quickly as possible so we can do our investigating right away, especially if we don't have to wait for the lab results or something
and
like that.
And with physicians, actually suspect cases are required to be reported as well. So the sooner we get a report,
the quicker we can
respond.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I jumped in.
That's okay. So this was back in late August. We had this crazy thing going on. We were like, 5 cases, what's going on here? And we really didn't find anything, so we kind of just wrapped up things and said, okay, it's not an outbreak, we're gonna keep moving. And then on September 8th, the Washington State Public Health Lab, which does kind of confirmatory testing, they'll follow up and do additional tests when they get a positive salmonella, just to get a little bit more specifics on it. They did what's called a PFGE, and basically that's just a DNA test that can match up DNA from different salmonella bugs, essentially, and see if it's the same bug or if it's different. Because if they're genetically the same, if the DNA is the same, they probably came from the same place, right? So if you find a bunch that match in DNA, you know, okay, these came from a common source, we got to figure something out. They came back and said, all 5 of those cases have the same DNA. So we had to go back and we were like, okay, we need to ask more intensive questions, we need to follow up with these people again, see if there's something we missed, to see where, you know, their common exposure could have come from. That same day, the Oregon Health Authority reached out to us and said, hey, we have 12 salmonella cases also with that same DNA match. So then we started partnering with them, saying, okay, there's got to be some sort of common exposure here. That's just way too many to be a coincidence. After doing some more interviews, a little bit more digging, we actually found out that 11 of the 14 cases we were able to interview all reported some sort of seafood exposure. Almost all of them specified sushi. So that's kind of where we got our heads on, okay, we're going with sushi. It's a high-risk food to begin with because it's a lot of raw products. And so we kind of directed our attention from there. We send our environmental health specialists out to do inspections and gather samples and more information. But the interesting part of this outbreak investigation so far was there were at least 3 or 4 different restaurants that all of these people had eaten at. So what that told us was it wasn't just one restaurant, it was probably somebody who was producing the food and sending it to these restaurants. So it was kind of a bigger picture and we had to kind of look further down the chain. At this point, our case count was 17 with 5 in Clark County and then the 12 in Oregon. So then on September 11th, we had collected all these samples, we sent them off to the lab. They were samples of the fish that the restaurants had, fish and rice and a lot of different things that we sent off for testing to see if there was salmonella present in that. Based on our evidence and looking at what people had eaten so far, we had specifically kind of narrowed our thinking down to either raw salmon or raw tuna, because that's what most people have reported eating and were kind of high-risk foods. And then based on that information that we got from invoices, we also were able to narrow it down to a company called Pacific Seafoods, which is just a large national seafood distributor who had distributed a lot of the tuna and salmon that we were talking about. By the 11th, our case count was up to 22. We had identified a couple more people with that same DNA pattern. And then by September 15th, we had an additional 3 cases identified. And what was unique about these were it was outside of the Portland metro area, which was where all of our cases started. We now have cases in Hawaii, one in New Jersey, who didn't have any travel out west. And we were kind of like, okay, what is happening with this now? We also, on that same day, had one of our tuna samples came back and was positive for salmonella. So that kind of confirmed some of our hypothesis that it was salmonella in the tuna. And we told all of our restaurants, you know, if you have this tuna of this specific product, hold it, don't serve it. We think it might, you know, be making people sick. And then on the 27th, we got more results on that tuna sample. They did that DNA matching that I mentioned, and they said, sorry, the salmonella doesn't match the salmonella in all your people. So we kind of took a step backwards and had to say, okay, now what? In addition to that, we had 4 new cases identified in 3 new states, Texas, Florida, and California, and our case count was up to 30. So at this point, because we're looking at 7 different states, we haven't really been able to pin down what exactly was happening. and we had gone all the way back to the producer level, which had produced the fish over in Southeast Asia. There were a lot of moving parts and things working on a national and even international scale. So the Centers for Disease Control and U.S. Food and Drug Administration actually stepped in and from here took on the investigation just because it had grown. And what started with this tiny little county cluster quickly grew to be something that they took on at the federal level. So as of today, the investigation is continuing at that level. They're doing some advanced lab testing, some more sample collection, and trying to trace back and see what exactly the source of this illness was. We thankfully haven't received any more lab results or identified any more cases identified with this, so we're hoping that whatever it ended up being, we've stopped the risk and we've ended up preventing more people from getting ill. Although local restaurants, we do still have them holding their Pacific Seafoods tuna, just in case that was the source of making people ill. And thankfully, we've had no media inquiries or publications, which we love getting to share information with stakeholders and community members, but it can be very challenging in an ongoing investigation because information changes so quickly. We saw it one day, we were like, it's for sure the tuna. And the next day we were like, we're not super sure it was the tuna. So with how rapidly things change, a lot of times it's really nice to be able to complete an investigation before sharing that information with the stakeholders, which is why that's really the last piece in our investigation. So really, just wrapping things up, like I said, investigating, identifying, and responding to foodborne illnesses in the community is really a foundational public health service. It's something that the local health jurisdiction prides itself on being able to do, and it's really something that no other agency has the capacity to do, so it's something that we really think is important that we do here. But as we saw in this outbreak, it can be really tough to identify an outbreak and respond to it quickly, especially if it unravels. New cases are identified quickly and are hard to tie to an outbreak. But clear time and communication collaboration with our partners has really allowed us on both a local level as well as outside of a local level with other states or across the country. It's really allowed us to have a strong outbreak response system. So that's pretty much all I have for you guys. This is my contact information. If you have questions about this or anything communicable disease related, give me a holler, and I'll either try to answer your question or pass it along.
So I was just wondering, with kind of a general event, obviously this one doesn't sound like it was typical, but what is a typical timeline? Because I'm thinking about when it's first reported and what's happening in the interim with the food and
So yeah, you're right. This is a very atypical one, especially since it's now at like the federal level, which moves at a different pace than we move at. When it's something that's just localized to Clark County, we really have been able to respond to most of our outbreaks within a week to 10 days. And that's from first identification of our cases or our little cluster or our outbreak. Usually that first day, we try to get the people on the phone, we try to figure out exactly what it was that they ate, what exposures they had. We have our environmental health specialists out at the facilities, giving them information, looking for issues, and communicating with them how to implement control measures so that more people aren't getting sick in the community. And if we can collect that data right away on the first day, we can analyze that the next day and really make some conclusions, make sure that the problems are resolved within a week or 10 days.
Embellish this a little bit. So it really depends, the timeline depends on where, for example, it depends on where the contamination occurs.
Right.
So let's say this is a food handler who's ill and just maybe handles one batch of food and people consume it and then that food is gone. The outbreak may be over fairly quickly unless you get people transmitting it to each other. If you have something that's out in commercial production, let's say some beef that comes from a processing plant that may be out in circulation for a while, or some fish that is sold in supermarkets and may be frozen for a while and you can be contaminated and be still in the supermarket for months, you can get outbreaks that go on for weeks or months. What she was talking about in terms of the PFGE, one of the great things about PFGE is a genetic testing we have. We originally thought that these cases that might occur in Hawaii or Oregon or Washington might have been sporadic, but we now know that they may be related to each other because they're genetic matches. And if the contamination is occurring on the feedlot or on the farm, that food can be in production for a long time and get a lot of people sick over a long period of time, which is why having a local public health department that can identify this and work with other health departments, get the genetic testing, and get food, identify if you can what the food is, and get it out of production before it continues to make more people sick over months. I'd also point out that if you remember, when was it, last year, the year before, we had a national outbreak from the Chipotle chain. We identified the first couple of cases here, and that turned out to be a national outbreak. So the point I'm trying to make is having a strong public health department at the local level is essential, not only protecting Clark County, but actually protecting everybody, you know, nationally and perhaps even internationally. So I'm going on and on, but the answer to your question about timeline is it depends on where the breakdown occurs and where the contamination occurs. And some of these things, you know, if you get involved early enough, you can protect a whole lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this must be, for you, this must be really exciting stuff, right?
I'll never publicly admit that I love outbreaks.
So, you know the old publisher perish thing. And we expect to see an article from you
or at least look for my name on something that somebody is writing up. You know, there are a lot of players involved with some of this stuff. So it's certainly been an interesting ride, and I've been really excited to be involved with it just because it's been a great learning experience. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing comes along once and maybe every couple years. And while you hate to see people getting sick, and that is our whole goal, is to make sure people don't get sick, when it does, it's really exciting to get to put your tools to use, the things that you've kind of been training for and studying. So, yeah.
Okay, so one more question. So do we have the lab here in Clark County?
We don't technically. A lot of the initial lab results get done by commercial labs. So if you're at the Kaiser, they'll send it to the Kaiser lab and things like that. But where all the public health testing gets done is usually up at the Washington State Public Health Lab. Up near Seattle. Oregon Public Health Lab also does some of the stuff depending on where the person was seen.
So what's really cool is, so the state lab will do the PFGE, pulse field gel electrophoresis, that's a genetic test, and then it actually gets uploaded to the CDC. There's a national database that the CDC has, and that's where, so state labs do these tests, and then it goes to the results go to the CDC, and they can actually match the results. That's how we find out that the Hawaii Public Health Lab is sending its results to the CDC. That's how they're able to compare them and see that these, and I'd be happy to talk about PFGE at length. It's kind of really interesting stuff if you want to be bored. But that's how it works. So we do the salmonella is identified here plus a local commercial lab can identify the species, Salmonella paratyphi, and the subtype below that. But then the genetic testing is done at the state lab.
Keisha, did you have a question?
I did, but then I think I want to actually forget it. You're still having them hold the tuna currently because while it wasn't the same salmonella, there was still salmonella.
Correct, yeah. And salmonella is bad. We don't want that in our tuna. It was different salmonella than what made our people sick, so that's why we're like, well, now we can't like definitively tie that tuna to these people's illness.
Right.
We don't want to serve. And all of the restaurants we talked to were like, yeah, great, fine, we don't want to get people sick. That's not what we're here to do. So it wasn't a big deal for them to switch to a different distributor, and they've probably all thrown that away now. So. Sure. Holding is a more technical term.
If you want to learn how that all works, if you go to the CDC site and look up PulseNet, that's the site where they do the pulse field gel electrophoresis results.
But salmonella is a lot of places, and there's different types of salmonella. It's being from animal
medicine.
There's salmonella all the time.
And
it's,
we
don't freak out.
So in chicken,
it's there.
In poultry,
you don't
want
to eat it.
In poultry, it's not even considered, in beef, it's not even considered an adulterant. It, Salmonella is ubiquitous in chicken. We generally don't eat raw chicken.
So yeah, that's my point. Is it's just tuna that's for, I mean, obviously we don't eat raw chicken because it has a large level of salmonella, even mm-hmm. if it's freshly processed. But it, can you just say, don't feed this? I mean, it kind of the Stephanie's point is like, I mean, it seems like a big economic, you know, issue mm-hmm. too. I mean, don't want to shut down everybody's, you know, so can you say, as a public health parent, cook the tuna to a certain degree and then it's okay? Or can you even manage
yes,
that?
Yes, so that's kind of ties in, like, if you go to a restaurant and you eat something undercooked, there's always kind of that warning on there that's like, hey, we are responsible if you get sick from eating this. The other thing is, you know, with chicken, we know that it's, you're going to get salmonella if you eat raw chicken. It's less common in raw fish, like tuna stuff. It's been, obviously, we've seen it there, mm-hmm. But it is less common, so, you know, we have this perception of decreased risk. You know, it's not as dangerous to eat raw fish as it is to eat raw chicken or something.
But people ought to know also that, you know, how do vegetables get some cross-contamination is one. That's one of the things we look at when we do restaurant inspections, that somebody didn't just cut up some raw chicken on a cutting board and then make some salad on mm-hmm. it. So there's a lot of ways to spread the bad news around.
I want to give them a big shout out too, because the toolkit that they developed was not something that we actually had in-house. And it actually is an element of incident command. So it's really gets us to where we have an actual plan for operations in case this thing scales up and it ends up being something where we have to go into incident command and bring in other resources. So it's really that whole plan for the operations. They've done a terrific job in putting that together. So just wanted to bring in emergency response
on this. My question is, did we get her a fellowship because we're all effed up, or because we're really, really good?
I'll let you draw the conclusion on that one.
Well, if there's nothing else, I'll take it out of your hair. But like I said, reach out to me if you have any questions with stuff. I love talking about this.
Yeah, we want to know the results when the
Sometimes, unfortunately, we never know for sure. So it's nice when you can completely, the holy grail of this is finding it in the food somewhere. But, you know, it might be out of production by now, so we may know, depending on how the food moves through production, we may, just so you know, we may never know for sure.
Years ago, I was involved in a Shigella outbreak.
Oh, yeah.
In a small community. Uh-huh. And we were able to finally locate it to the healthcare worker. What was so hard about it, they moved her all around the facility, and the facility was actually attached to a hospital.
So let me tell you something about Shigella, which you probably won't like, but Shigella is not carried in, so the Shigella that infects people is only found in people. So you had to be exposed to human stool somehow to get Shigella. We had an outbreak of Shigella at Kleinlein Pond a few years ago that we investigated, and we found out that they had their toddlers with diapers in the pond, and people were swimming.
Not medical?
Huh?
Non-medical? Shigella is?
Shigella is.
Oh, Shigella's a bacteria.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It's the same bacteria. There's different subgroups of it. It's the same bacteria that causes dysentery, but you've got, you know, non-dysentery type. It's nasty. You can get bloody diarrhea with it. But it's actually particular to humans.
Okay.
So you can't get Shigella from your dog, for example, from a cat.
We got solved, we thought, and then it flared back up again in secondary cases.
Yeah.
You
know, it only takes a few bugs to transmit it.
Going to live with
nasty.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Do you guys get any of the notifications? We have had a couple really big salmonella outbreaks in dog food. I'm sure you've probably heard about that. Is that something that the CDC gets excited about, or does anybody?
Probably the Department of Ag or maybe more
excited. Or FDA, things like that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they'll send us notifications just like, hey, if you have cases of salmonella, ask about if they have dogs and if they feed them this food, for example. Because, you know, if say they have it in dog food or something like that, if you're feeding your dog food and you're scooping your hand into that bag and you don't wash your hands before, then you eat, and that's how you get it. So
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And I think that's something. And we had a huge recall, and, you know, it was a big deal a couple years ago, a really big deal, and then it was traced back to some of the Chinese, some of the medicine. for not medicine, but some of the foods were from China and some of the chicken that was put into dog foods. Anyways, but yeah,
you probably see that a lot and hear about that a lot.
So. Yeah, and then dogs poop out that bacteria too, and that's why the CDC really doesn't like
well, you should wash your hands after dealing,
yeah.
After cleaning up the, after cleaning up the dog poop.
But people do that. No, they just
people do a lot of weird stuff.
That's what keeps us in business. People bring their toddlers to Klein Line Pond and let them wash their diapers in the, you know, it's perpetual employment.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
All right, so we are going to move on to Dr. Malik, who's going to give us an update on the tipping fee ordinance.
So for those of you, if you have trouble sleeping at night, you can go onto the grid and watch Board of County Councilors or Board of Health meetings. Actually, they're really fascinating. They passed the tipping fee ordinance. So thanks to the help from the Public Health Advisory Council, I think you guys did a letter of support, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And remember the, and I'm not going to go into it, we presented the whole reasons for doing that, but you can remember that funding was from what's called the Model Toxic Control Act, which provides funding for a lot of our solid waste programs, has been dropping over the last few years, and then the legislature failed to pass the capital budget, which resulted in more cuts to us. We went to the to the board of county councilors. We did a two-step process. We had a kind of a work session at the Board of Health meeting, presented the data to them. They were supportive of it. They passed a tipping fee ordinance that actually increases the fee on residential, we're talking about residential garbage, by $1.43 per ton, which to the homeowner, that amounts to about 7 cents a month for their curbside pickup. So the tipping fee went up, and I have a copy of the ordinance if folks want to see it, at about 1.6%. So it went from a very small increase, but that actually helps keep our solid waste programs intact. And do I need to add anything else? Or
I thought you were talking about cows.
I didn't want to give you a bum steer. So.
Oh, here we go.
You asked, but no, I'm sorry.
And this doesn't impact the whole recycling issue that we're having, right? They're not.
Oh, you're talking about the Chinese. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you may have heard or read in the news that China, that purchases a lot of our recycling, has a problem with the quality of the recycling in the beginning, and so that's putting a pressure on the value of the recycled materials. It's lowering it because they're not purchasing it. That really relates to commercial waste, not to the residential waste that we were talking about. So it relates to commercial recycling. So that's a separate issue than what we're talking about in terms of our residential garbage.
It's not just Washington.
China's not. I mean, people tend to, you know, you can combine your recycling. It gets people more interested in recycling, but when some of the stuff gets mixed in, it becomes more difficult to separate out later on.
Yeah.
And China's not happy with what they're getting. But that's different, and we let the board know this. It's different than the residential tipping fee that we were talking about. So our programs are solid for now.
Solid.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. So we're going to then, Dr. Malik's also going to give us an update on foundational public health services.
So, and I'm going to talk about the grant. So you may recall that, I'll do this as quickly as possible. We've been suffering in local and state public health with lack of funding. We're always talking about that. in terms of key, what we call foundational public health services that we deliver on a regular basis. And a year, probably more than a year ago, local health jurisdictions and including us and the State Department of Health quantified the amount of money we'd need to make our system whole so we could actually do what we call foundational public health services, which include things like adequate communicable disease control that we just presented to you. And we had an ask of the governor and the legislature for $60 million for the biennium. And obviously we didn't get what we fully asked for. And the $60 million was really a down payment for what we needed. The legislature and the governor gave all the local public health jurisdictions in the state and DOH a total of $12 million for the next biennium. And actually it goes retroactive to July of this year. So it's July 2017 to July of 2019. So they gave us $12 million with $2 million to the state, and the rest of the $10 million distributed to local health departments. And we got Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, $259,000 per year. $259 and $70 a year for the next 2 years, retroactive to July, to do foundational public health services. And there's some metrics associated with that. And we're going to use it primarily to beef up, and that's not a pun with cows, to beef up our communicable disease program. And there's a list of foundational public health services. It includes chronic disease prevention as well. And it includes what we call foundational capabilities like our assessment, our ability to do epidemiology assessment. But we're primarily going to use the funding which the state asked us to do for communicable disease control. Of that $10 million that was distributed around the state to local health jurisdictions, local health jurisdictions in the state agreed to hold $1 million back. And the $1 million held back was to, and by the way, when the end of this funding period is over, because we got the state to give the legislature to give us $10 million, we have to demonstrate to them how much better things are and what we were able to accomplish. Well, they held $1 million back for some innovative, what they called shared services. So, especially for some of the smaller jurisdictions that have problems with capacity, the idea that health departments can get together, local health jurisdictions can get together and share some of their services, is a way of doing things more efficiently. And we figured if we could find some innovative ways of using this $1 million in shared services, we might be able to demonstrate to the legislature why they should give us more funding to do more of that. And it's more efficient. So the state issued an RFP for some shared service models and $500,000 each year, or $1 million for the biennium, was available for 2 to 3 projects to do a shared services demonstration. We were one of 7 applicants. We got together, we spoke to Klickitat, Skamania, Cowlitz, and Wakayakum about doing a shared service project. And I have the grant application if you're interested, but we met with them, and actually we met with the Cowlitz tribe as well, so we included the Cowlitz tribe in our shared services application. And it was going to be mainly around what their needs were, which is more epidemiology capacity for the region, so to help support communicable disease control. So we were one of 7 applicants. Well, the bad news is we were not one of the recipients, and I have some concerns about the way it came out, and I've already shared that with Salfo, managing the State Association of Local Public Health Officials, managing director. I'm going to bring it up at the statewide meetings in November. The 3 recipients were, one of them was Spokane, and they actually had what I thought was true shared services. And for me, shared services means you share with your regional neighbors. It doesn't make sense to do it otherwise from my perspective, because you're hearing my bias. And Spokane had a project where they're going to provide shared services with their neighboring local health jurisdictions. The other 2 awardees, one was Seattle King County Public Health, and they were offering to provide a tuberculosis resource and tuberculosis investigation to the entire state, all 35 jurisdictions. Well, we don't need any help from Seattle King County here in doing TB, and it didn't make sense to me to award a shared services grant to Seattle for doing TB in some counties, large counties like ours that are 160, 170 miles away. And actually, I'm biased. I think in some cases, I like what we do better with TB than Seattle King does. For example, we do directly observed therapy for all our active cases, and Seattle only does it for their active pulmonary cases or lung cases. So that was one of the awardees, and I've already told the Wasalpa folks that we're not interested, and then I was informed that Seattle is offering this by request only. So it's only for people who request help. And there's actually other places that you can get help from. For example, if I have a weird TB question, I can call Francis Curry National TB Center. They get federal funding, and they have a warm line, and I get what I need. I mean, I've been doing TB for many years, and we feel pretty comfortable with it here. The other grantee was Tacoma Pierce Health Department. And their plan was to work with some shared, what they call shared services. One of their shared counties is Yakima, and they're providing, I'm not sure I completely understand what they asked for, and I'll get more information, but they're talking about putting together resources for healthcare providers. Well, we have a relationship with our healthcare providers here, and it's kind of, I'm not sure what Tacoma Pierce can provide that we can't provide here. So I was a little bit disappointed. We'll push back at the state, but I just wanted to give you an update.
They're the two largest in the state, right?
So, yeah, they're the two largest. We're the fifth largest. So, you know, Seattle, Tacoma, Snohomish, Spokane, and then us. But we actually have a population center down in the southwest. You know, there's three population centers in the state, the Puget Sound, Spokane, and us. And
that requires flipping the map over when you're in the second page.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's just the nature of when you talk about shared services, the nature of what they're doing, it's like their central repository that just beefs up their budget, supposedly to help the state.
And I'm thinking if we need a central suppository. I'm sorry, I was thinking of Salmonella. If we need a central repository, that seems like something the state ought to do, and that's not for me. That's not the purpose of shared services. Right. And we, you know, Seattle, when they did their application, they never reached out to us and said, "What do you need?" Same thing with Tacoma; they never reached out to us. But when we wanted to do it with our neighboring counties, we actually met with them and we asked them. We spent some time with them and asked them what they needed, and that's why we put that forward. So I was pretty disappointed in that. Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to say, too, that the process that we used was actually really good, and we had an opportunity to really have some great conversations with our partners, with our partnering counties, and we got a good idea of kind of where they feel like their gaps are. So, you know, we're still committed to continuing to support them. We've already done, and Madison's team has already done a lot of work with surrounding counties in healthcare-acquired infection and protocols, and helping their long-term care facilities really look at how they're handling, you know, what their protocols are to really manage those healthcare-acquired infections. And so that's one example of a shared service. Another thing is we're doing an FP in Cowlitz County as a shared service, and that's something that we're going to continue to do. So,
and we provide health officer officer services for Skamania County. Mm-hmm. So
we're still committed to doing that, and I'm excited though that we actually, this process, in spite of the fact that it didn't end up with us getting the grant, I think it was still a great conversation to have with our partners, and we have a much better idea about where the gaps are in our region, which is, I think, is going to be helpful collectively for all of us.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
So that was, does anybody have any questions or?
Who made the decisions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the other thing that I thought was weird about the process was because we were the applicants and county health departments are the applicants, none of us could actually review these grant applications. But on the other hand, we're the ones who have know what it's like on the ground level, but because of conflict of interest, we couldn't be on the interview. So there was a team of three that did the score of the grants. One was the managing director for the Washington State Association of Local Public Health Officials. Number two was, I can't remember her name, from the State Board of Health. So person, the director of the State Board of Health. And the third person was Scott Lindquist, who's the epidemiologist for the state. So the three of them scored the applications.
Do they all reside in Seattle?
No. In fairness, I don't know where Scott lives, but he works in Olympia, and so does the WASALFO managing director. And I'm not sure where the Board of Health is located, but that's Puget Sound. But no, I mean they're not. I don't think they have any bias about that. I they're all really good people. I just don't think that. Well, Scott used to be a public health director. And the WASALFO, Jamie, used to be a public health director in Wisconsin, so they know something about what it's like to be at a local health department, but this is the way it turned out, and you know, I'm not sure exactly. One of the hypotheses I have, which was a problem I had with the application itself, is they were looking more about innovation and something shiny to present to the legislature, something that sounded pretty impressive. And my feeling, and I'm a curmudgeon when it comes to working with the state about this stuff, my feeling was instead of doing this RFP at the beginning, they should have reached out to local health jurisdictions and seen where organically people were doing shared services already mm-hmm. and talking to each other and just put some incentives to do more of that and have more of it spread around the state. The other reason I thought that might work better is that we have to convince the legislature. So we have a close relationship with our delegation here in our region. And the more they could have spread this out and shared services between, more shared services between jurisdictions throughout the state, the more legislators we could have engaged around this. Mm-hmm. So then when we ask for more funding later on, that would have been, you know, we would have had more opportunity there. But they wanted something shiny, and I heard that term, something innovative and shiny, and they obviously felt like the Seattle and the Tacoma Paris ones were shiny.
They're pretty narrow, and they could show some kind of outcomes.
I don't know how the Seattle thing is going to show some outcomes around TV. I'm trying to rack my brain.
Well, maybe number of county requesting. It could be a real simple.
Yeah, people requesting more help.
Like what were the tangibles
there? Yeah, they had some criteria, and if you're interested, we looked at the RFP and we wrote our application to address the criteria that they had. I
think that they did say that one of the strengths of our application was that we did involve the tribe mm-hmm. and we involved partners. So I think that was seen as something that was possible.
Well, it seems like if they're going to do it again in 2 years, you're mm-hmm. one step ahead of something.
Yeah, and we had 2 years.
So they
Well, I mean, you have 2 years. You have your years to make
to
a case,
right? To give advice, yes, exactly.
And then you're still going to do something. So when you do the application, you can say, "Look what we've done. This right. just means we've laid this groundwork. We can be that much better."
So their criteria related to project need, project description, impact and evaluation, so you had an evaluation component, and scalability. So there are things like that in the budget.
Just think about the impact of what Seattle King is doing. When you talk about statewide, it has a bigger, it's shiny.
Right.
I can tell you, I can give you the description. So the Tacoma one, which I don't understand, is they'll share technical and subject matter expertise to develop and maintain tailored provider resource websites to interested local health jurisdictions, customized to the partner local health jurisdiction's unique provider and community needs. And it's supposedly to save us time and money. And so I'm not sure, the target populations, and that they're calling it a provider resource website, I include but are not limited to medical providers, healthcare systems, hospitals, clinics, school districts, school nurse leads, healthcare agencies, long-term care facilities, corrections, emergency response, EMS, fire, pharmacies, and health department staff. Why would I want our partners to look to Tacoma peers for resources or for information that we could provide with a local? But that's, this is a description from Tacoma peers. The Seattle one is, aims to foster a statewide tuberculosis control and preventive collaboration through two mechanisms. Because half the cases of TB occur in King County, they say they have expertise in managing them and doing complex contact investigations. We've done incredible contact investigations here, and I'd be happy to share with you folks, but they want to establish a TB response team for all 35 local health jurisdictions, provide on-site support, and use on-demand video conferencing to interface with local health jurisdictions around the state. And then they want to expand services currently offered by TB Echo, which is the extension for community health outcomes, which is a multi-point video conference platform to gather together a virtual community of healthcare professionals interested in TB control and prevention. And it's a collaboration with UW. We have a very active ID, Infectious Disease Advisory Council. We just had a meeting, actually we're up at Legacy. We rotate between Legacy and Peace Health. We involve the infection prevention coordinators and the ID docs in the community, Sally Williams, Andy Root. We meet regularly to talk about things like TB. We work our TB cases together. I just don't understand why we need this support. And by the way, we have the capability to directly observe therapy all over the world. We've monitored our TB patients in Kabul, in Moldova, in all over the world. So we just had one of our active TB cases just visited India, and we're doing directly observed therapy via Skype with him in India. So we're totally capable here, and we have a relationship with local infectious disease providers and pulmonologists here. So I'm finding it hard to see why I would want to reach to Seattle to get to do some distant video conferencing from Seattle. So, my interest here is we don't provide a direct service TB. We provide some consultation and we do the directly observed therapy. But our interest is in getting our local providers, including our infectious disease providers, enough experience that we build our own community capacity around TB. And our ID partners and Peace Health and Legacy are great partners around TB control here. So anyway, I'm going on and on, but it just doesn't seem how this would benefit us, although we could benefit Skamania and Calais and Wakayakum if we were allowed to do that. So
it gets back to maybe tightening up the definition of shared services for the future,
I sent her, RWJ has had this program, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has had this shared services program and grant mechanism for several years. And if you look at it, almost all of the recipients are doing a regional approach, which is what Spokane is talking about doing. So anyway, that was what happened. I'll keep you informed. See what happens, and I wish them all good luck. It's just this is a resource that's not going to really help us out a whole lot.
We are with the foundational public health dollars that we did get, we are expanding our EPI capacity and some other things within our agency. So we are continuing to look at beefing up that infrastructure for exactly the stuff that they were talking about earlier today. So tonight.
Okay, so just a note that we are going to go dark in November. So we're going to not have a public health meeting in November. It falls in the same week as Thanksgiving, so we're going to pass on that. And the next meeting will then be December 19th.
Turkey well. Yes. Use a thermometer. Just get people to use thermometers, I'd be thrilled.
Wash your hands.
Yes. Well, I think people should avoid putting stuffing in the cavity. I would recommend that people cook the stuffing separately because it's really hard to get, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on again, get that internal temperature up when you have the stuffing inside.
Yeah.
So.
Ham.
Well, we can talk about Listeria if you want.
I'm just glad that she didn't show gas stations as the source of the salmonella. So I'm
you don't want the tapeworm.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was cut you off.
And the other note is just that the nominating committee is meeting on October 27th. So that meeting is on Friday to nominate the 2018 executive committee members. So at the next meeting in December, the members will have a chance to vote on the proposed slate of officers. So if you're interested in being considered for 2018, please get in touch with Steve, Joan, or Melanie. All right, just a little bit of time to open it up to council members if you have any updates you want to share.
There's a follow-up children's summit on October 24th, SELF, Support for Early Learning and Families in Southwest Washington Early Learning. It's at Warehouse 23. It's very inexpensive. It's like $35. But you could just come for lunch if you wanted to, but it's a follow-up to the State of the Children's Report. Governor's wife is going to be here, so if you're interested in early learning, and it'll be from like 9 to 4, and then we could go to the, I'll go from there to the Peace Health and FPA. All right, so yeah, so, and I think I sent that out last, I sent that to Lydia, and I think she sent that out to everybody, but I could send it out again if.
It's in the notes, and I did send, yeah.
Yeah. But you could just come for lunch if you want to hear the speakers at lunch. And the, you know, the reason there's a fee, the Community Foundation is funding it, but there's a fee for the lunch, so it'd be $35 to come hear the speakers at lunch, including the governor's wife.
So last month we got the NOAA winter weather briefing for winter 2018. It's going to look like the winter 2017.
Fun. Quite rain long enough to snow.
Yeah, it's going to be quite rainy.
I love this.
We're working with Clark County Public Health Emergency Preparedness. We've got a meeting coming up here with healthcare, hospitals, EMS transport on winter weather surge capacity, winter weather planning. Note, Portland Bureau of Transportation is not anticipating having any better luck clearing the roads in 18 than they did in 17.
Stay in Vancouver.
Huh?
Stay in Washington.
Yeah, stay in
Washington. Well, are they going to use salt next year on that or no?
No.
Okay, still would be, yeah.
So they're using a salt-based solution.
Magnesium solution, yeah. Okay.
So,
same thing they used last year.
Pretty much.
Okay.
So the other thing that we're working with Clark County Public Health Emergency Preparedness on, so last winter and both in the fire season, we had a need for disaster sheltering. We were supporting those operations in Skamania County. We had a very big potential to do that here in Clark County. The bulk of our disaster sheltering comes from the American Red Cross from across the river. It's a great organization. They do good things. They have limited capacity. And on both occasions, we were told to send people across the river. So we're working with public health to develop a sheltering mechanism for Clark County that is not reliant on that organization. It has nothing to do with an anti-Red Cross bias. It's a realization that they're a limited resource that is quickly going to get taxed across the river. We're involving public health because we know that your desire or your need for sheltering is directly tied to your economic resilience. If I evacuate Phillida, I'm going to shelter about 10% of the population. If I evacuate Fruit Valley, I'm sheltering about 70% of the population. And with that lower economic resilience comes a higher likelihood that they're not going to be as healthy, they're not going to have a lot of the other things that in a sheltering environment can quickly spell really makes Doc happy and the young lady at the end. But so that's why we're working with them to help develop those methodologies to integrate all the partners so that we're creating healthy shelter environments that are staffed by other community partners.
You might one good example of that is the hepatitis A outbreak that's been occurring in the homeless population in San Diego, and I think it's been spreading north somewhat. Yeah.
So those are some things. So you might want to start talking to some of your partners, some of your patients, if they're on any type of clinical visits that can be impacted by being isolated for 3 to 5 days due to snow, start planning for that now. Alternate routes, thinking about it. If you're having concerns about being isolated in your home for 3 to 5 days because of winter weather, start preparing for that now. If any of you commute, how many of y'all heard the boil the ocean bag?
Yep, you shared that with us.
Okay.
What? No, no way.
I'll send you the link.
Okay.
So have something in your primary mode of transportation in case you get stuck. That's all I got.
I've got something, it's called GeneSite, GeneSite.com. And for people who are on Medicaid, it's free genetic testing to determine medications, how medications will work for you. It's really important, particularly with people that have developmental disabilities and mental health issues, because people with developmental disabilities, medications don't work the way that they're supposed to work for them. And then with mental health issues, sometimes the medications don't work because their bodies can't break down the medication to effectively absorb it. And so for people who are on Medicaid, doctors can go in, sign up for this, and then the people can get their blood test or whatever done, and it's free. It is a free testing, and it usually costs about $1,200.
So what's the website again, or what is it?
GeneSite, GeneSite.com.
Any other updates?
I should give you guys a little update. So based on what's going on, usually the way we predict the flu season here is we look what's going on in the southern hemisphere, because they're in the opposite. Their winter is ending. They're in spring now while we're in fall. And they've been hit pretty hard. The majority of the, I'm remembering off the top of my head, the influenza A is H3N2. Which tends to be more severe. And so they've had a pretty severe flu season in the southern hemisphere. And right now it looks like the vaccine that we have here, and it's gonna be hard to tell until we actually have the flu here and we've had enough cases. But right now it looks like the vaccine is probably a pretty good match. So we're always encourage people to get vaccinated now. But the prediction so far is it'll be a flu season. Last year was pretty severe. Somewhat similar to, you know, severity of last year, because we're dealing with H3N2, which is a particular flavor of influenza. So we're still on the last week, we had 5% of tests reported were positive. That's below the 10% threshold. So flu season hasn't started yet, but we're monitoring really closely. Madison, who you met here, has really done a great job of polishing up our influenza surveillance reports that we share with folks, including the hospitals. But now's the time to get your flu shot.
I have a question about the vaccine. So about the time that we were starting to do our vaccine campaign at the hospital, all employees are expected to be vaccinated. And about that same time is when the hurricanes hit. And one of the things that I heard on the news that I didn't ever know was that about 25% of our pharmaceuticals are produced in Puerto Rico, and of course they were now without power, still without power, and thinking, so what happens to all those pharmaceuticals that are stored in potentially buildings with no, you know, without proper temperature? Have you heard anything about
that? I haven't heard about any vaccine shortage, and as far as I know, there's no vaccine shortage.
We actually, our employee health is on hold waiting.
Good, okay. So, we've got ours, so
yeah.
Legacy?
We have ours. We have it for the patients, but it's the employee health.
Really?
Yeah.
Do we have it for all the employees there?
Do you know where they're getting it from?
I don't know, because they did mention this in the safety huddle a couple days ago.
Our pediatrician ran out.
We started, and then because of the shortage, you know, I think the priority
I don't know who our supplier is.
No tuna for him.
Because of all the stuff that was in the air from the fire or whatever, my proximity to it, living in Camas, I developed bronchitis, and I'm still suffering some of the effects from it. Was there anything, I mean, did you see anything, I mean, about the number of people in our community that were affected by that?
I ask our hospital partners here. Obviously, it's a risk for respiratory illness, and they're not notifiable, so I don't know. But I mean, our recommendation was, you know, stay indoors if you have respiratory problems.
I wasn't listening.
I know. We try to get information out. We may not have done a good enough job because the particulate levels are significantly lower indoors than they are out. So, I hadn't heard of any big spikes.
I expected more than what I heard.
Well, I heard the announcements. Mm-hmm. I just didn't think anything of it. I just went in and went outside and did what I normally did.
I had something to share, and that is that after 15 years with Peace Health and 27 years with Seattle Children's Hospital, I'm going to stop working full time.
Oh my God.
So I'm excited, but at the same time, kind of sad because I absolutely love Peace Health, and of course, Children's Hospital is amazing too. And so I've been really blessed to get to work in amazing organizations. And in this job, which is actually the best job at Peace Health, get to work with all of you and other community-based organizations. So I'm looking for a great Peace Health person, and Ellen, I'd be interested in any suggestions you have, maybe Roxanne, that will take the Peace Health seat as I turn it over. So this will be my last meeting as the Peace Health representative. But I can't tell you how much I love this work. It's great work, and you're all an amazing team. Thank you for letting me be part of it.
That's very sad.
Part of the
Homeless
Advisory Council, so it's
been a real pleasure. Are you going to stay on the council
for homeless? Probably not. Yeah, but I haven't actually talked to
I won't say for it.
But I'm looking for, I actually have a recruit for that too.
Full-time job, finding something that's going to take on your space.
Yeah, you have to.
I don't every woman in the doing. Yeah, people.
She's everywhere. She's been everywhere.
So I had a chance to get to know Marla a little bit better, and it surprised me to find out that she actually has a zip line on her property. So I suspect in her retirement, we'll find her zip lining across her property. I think her husband put it in.
Is that how you get around on your property?
That's how
you
get to the lower part of the property.
That would be fine.
But yeah, back up, that's our exercise. But we just celebrate our 45th wedding anniversary. We decided that was a precipitating factor. We decided we have a lot more fun things that we want to do that require much more time, and so that's what we're going to be doing.
Congratulations.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Have you heard anything about hospital emergency departments and children with autism that are being kind of stacked?
Not here. I haven't. If you've got a reference or something, let me know.
I've got somebody, and it's really a very sad situation.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't.
Being staffed.
Well, I mean, they can't actually be put into a room because there's no medical necessity. So they're left in the emergency department, and they were in one emergency department for over a month, and they're in another emergency department right now. And they're 16 years old and nonverbal.
Yeah, I know that there's been other cases of, I mean, this is an issue around mental health where there are folks who end up in the ED and then there's no housing or no place for them afterwards that's suitable, and they end up sticking around in the ED for a while. And I know I've saw that.
Yeah.
So that's been an issue. I don't think it's unique to autism, though. I think it's been an issue that our services in terms of mental health are.
It's not just that, even it's but that's a big piece. There, it's broader. I was I worked in Peace Health in Bellingham, and this is just one example. An elderly, frail elderly woman who was living in senior housing, and she had gotten mixed up with her medication, and so then she was acting kind of goofy, and the manager of the place called the ambulance, and she ended up in the emergency department. But she, once they figured out what was wrong and got things straightened out, then there was no medical necessity to continue to keep her there.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was basically, you know, discharged back to her home, but they had locked her door and said she couldn't come back
right.
because they were afraid that she might have a problem there. So she remained in the ER because there was no safe discharge for her. And a few weeks later, we had a meeting with folks from CMS who, you know, pay the bills for things like that and either accept or reject the claims. And I said, so what are we expected to do and as a hospital in that situation? Are we just to, like, bring her to the sidewalk and say, be on your way? I mean, it's not something that we would ever do. Our mission would never allow it, and we would never want to. And the comment was, well, no, of course not. You can keep them here for as long as you think you need to, but we're not paying for it. And so when you have a number of those on a regular basis, it is a terrible dilemma because the hospital won't release them unless it feels like a safe discharge.
When I visited Peace Health ED, we had a similar situation where this person had been living in the ED basically for a month because you didn't want to put them out on the street and there was no...
And there's no location to put them.
But a child with autism,
it's
that's nonverbal in all that stimulus...
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about what it's like in an ED. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
a different doctor every 8 hours.
Yep.
I just can't imagine.
Yes, there's no good place. Even putting them inside the hospital, there's no good place. There's not the right people to take care of them to meet their needs and trying to get where they can go. It's a tough one.
I believe that we're done, but I believe we have to end in a certain fashion. Mm-hmm. Does anyone want to make a motion? Do we make a motion? I don't know why I can't remember this.
But I also don't think we have a quorum.
Oh.
So what we'll have to do is for the notes, we can just actually do that next time.
Yeah.
We can do 2 months in it.
Yeah.
We did go last time.
Four.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but we don't need a motion to adjourn unless somebody just feels like making a motion. No, then we can do it. No, we don't.
Okay.
Thanks,
okay.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Where is the meeting on the 27th? I think I'm supposed to be there.
27th. It's here.
Uh-huh.
It's on the third floor.
Uh-huh.
So if you check into customer service, they'll direct you to conference room 327. It's just down the hall, past customer service to your right.
Do you know what time?
I want to say 1:30, but let me look really, really quick. Hang on.
Debbie?
I don't know.
Huh.
Yeah, that's a good question. Not really.
So who's your English teacher that you like so much?
Melissa Havara.
Oh.
27.
Do you know Mr. Barnum? He was really good with my son. I liked him a lot.
So 1:30.
Okay, check in on the third floor. And